Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz Podcast. My guest today is music industry legend Miles Copeland. You know him as a manager, as a label owner, the consummate outsider and insider. Miles, glad to have you here.
Nice to be with you, Bob. Ask me anything you want.
Okay, what's the story? Was your father really in the CIA?
My father was, well, some people like to say, you know, for because it sounds exotic, perhaps, to say he was a spy. But in actual fact, he was what we would call an operative. In all the countries where he was working, you know, whether it be Damascus, Syria, or Lebanon, or Egypt, the heads of the country knew that he was operating for the CIA, which was really what they wanted, because they wanted a CIA guy that they could talk to. So in actual fact, yes, he was CIA, but he was an operative, you know. So I can't really say that he was a spy, although it does sound rather exotic to say that he was.
And when did you discover that this was his line of work?
Well, I was probably, I mean, when we were in Egypt, I was only 10 years old. And he, after we left Egypt, he resigned from the CIA. And I knew a few years after that that he was CIA, but I didn't really think much about it. And I never had any feeling that there was something wrong with influencing governments, let's say, because Lord knows, some governments do need influencing.
Well, there's a rumor that your father was involved in overthrowing the government in Syria. Was that true?
Well, that actually was true, but it was not something that had been planned in advance. I mean, as my father used to tell the story, he said, you know, I was having dinner with the General Zaim and the colonel from the military attaché of the American embassy, and we were talking, and he kind of brought up, you know, almost like philosophically, well, what would it take to overthrow a government? And I sort of thought about it, and I thought, well, you know, I guess you'd want to take the radio station, and then you'd want to, well, no, wait a minute. I think first you need a reason for overthrowing the government, then you take the radio. So anyway, they were talking philosophically. So they didn't think much about it, but apparently the general had stopped drinking and said, finally, he says, we can do this. We can do this. If the Americans help me, we can do this. And they thought, they all, you know, he and the military attaché thought, my God, the guy's serious here, you know. Well, you know what? Let him sleep it off. He'll forget about it the next day. Well, the next day he didn't forget about it. And he was on, okay, the Americans are going to help me, right? You know? And so he sends a telegram to the CIA office back in Washington and saying, you know, what do we do? This guy really wants to overthrow the government. You know, what's our position? And gets a cable back saying, you know, don't mess around, you know. We don't need this stuff, and we don't mess around in foreign affairs. And he tells the general, and the general says, but I'm going to do this. You must help me. And cable goes back and forth and back and forth. And finally, the general says, look, if you don't help me, I go to the Russians. So cable goes back to Washington. Look, this guy's serious. He's going to do this. Either we're with him or we're not with him. And if we don't go with him, he's going to go with the Russians. So what do we want to do? Cable comes back saying, well, you know, you're on the spot. Do what you got to do. So he staged an incident, which was at our house. You know, he one night, my father says, okay, you and your mother and the two kids, you know, you're going to leave the house and you're going to go away for the weekend. You know, what? But we want to go. Just go. You know, so out we went. And we come back a couple of days later and the house is full of bullet holes, and the legation had a bomb in the garden, you know, which we'd planted to make sure nobody would be hurt, of course. But this was the incident to create the atmosphere that the government had to come in and, you know, this general had to come in and save the country from these rebels, you know, which were, of course, completely made up. So he had, and then, of course, the general overtook the country. And, of course, my father then could claim as being the first American operative to overthrow a government by covert means. But it was not a planned thing where the CIA and back in Washington was plotting. You know, they just got stuck and decided they better go along with it because the guy was going to do it anyway.
So how many countries did you live in growing up?
I lived in Syria during that period. And then in Egypt, when Gamal Abdel Nasser became the president, and my father was organized, but was actually loaned to Nasser from the CIA to organize Egypt's secret intelligence organization. And then my father decided to go on his own with some other CIA guys, and they would form their own private CIA and go, and we moved to Lebanon. So I lived in Lebanon for 12 years. So I spent probably half of my early childhood in somewhere around the Middle East.
And to what degree did these experiences inform your career as a manager? What I'm really talking about is you're the first manager I know who took their band, in this case, the Police, around the world. How'd you decide to do that?
Well, I don't know that I could say with some sort of definite news or position to say, well, you know, because I grew up in Egypt, that's why I wanted to go play Egypt. But I knew Egypt existed. You know, I knew the rest of the world existed. And if there was one thing I knew about, you know, marketing and rock and roll and whatever, is that image counts for a lot. And, you know, if you look at the Beatles, it's long hair, or it's, you know, Elton John, wild clothes, or, you know, you go down the list of the real big superstars. There was always something that was grabbed your attention. It could be a photograph or a something about them, you know. And I always figured, well, you know, the Police, when I was managing the Police, I had two great advantages. One was there's only three guys, which means it was very inexpensive to move them around. And not only was it three guys, but it was at a period where having a lot of equipment was really not something as you needed. You know, it was actually better if you didn't have a lot of equipment. So it was a cheap operation. We could go to places nobody else went, you know. The other great advantage of the Police was they looked good. You know, I mean, Sting looked like, you know, you dress him up as an Arab and put him on a stallion, there's Lawrence of Arabia for you, you know. So I figured, well, if we're going to go for mystique and for glamour and for photographs, you know, and we're just a few of us, why not go to Egypt? And why not go to India and some exotic places? Because, you know, you take a picture of the Police riding camels with the pyramids in the background, that's a photograph that any music journalist who's busy trying to put his newspaper together for that week is going to think, well, that's a photo I could use. And that was sort of the mark. It was in a way, it was a marketing idea, you know, but it was also a lot of fun, you know, to kind of, you know, when we went to India, I dressed them up as Maharajas at the Taj Mahal Hotel. But it was definitely something that made them look glamorous. And a lot of people around the world be thinking, my God, what a wonderful, you know, what a hip happening group they must be. Look where they are. They're playing in India. They're playing in all these wild, exotic places. And it made them so different than everybody else. You know, anybody could play Boston or New York or London or whatever, you know. But Egypt, that was different.
Talking about marketing, was it your idea for the members of the band to all dye their hair blonde?
I will admit that was not my idea. However, when I saw it, I thought, Eureka, look. That's a look that it kind of glued them together as a group, just like the Beatles all wearing long hair or whatever, you know. It was like a glue, but they had done it actually for a Wrigley Spearmint gum commercial, and the people that wanted the commercial just said, we want a group and we want them all to be blonde hair, you know. And so they dyed their hair for the commercial, you know, to make a bit of extra money. But when I saw it, I recognized what the value of it was.
Okay, now these places you took the band were places where they hadn't had rock concerts before, and I would assume there were some bumps in the road, especially in India. What was your experience like playing in India?
Well, India was something where, you know, you sort of imagine what things are going to be, but you get to the place and you find out that things aren't quite what you imagined. You know, you imagine India, a big country, would at least have a PA system. Well, when I got to India, it took me a while to find somebody who would promote a show. But first thing I found out, of course, there was no PA system. The only one that existed was fine for 20 people or so. So I effectively had to figure a way to get a PA system into India, which meant hiring some very good carpenters who could build the big speaker cabinets. But they had no speakers in India. So I had to go to London to buy speakers and fly it back to India with speakers to give it to these carpenters to stick in the cabinet. So we actually built our own PA system for India. The other thing about India that was unique was that there had never been a rock concert of any size in India before. And we hired a 3,000 seat venue, open air. And the group, you know, we went out to do a sound check, as every band would, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you do your sound check to make sure everything's working for the show that night, which was going to be at 7 or 8 o'clock, you know, start. But of course, the audience had never heard a rock concert before, and they were beginning to come to the concert hall pretty early in the afternoon. So when the band started the sound check, the audience thought the concert had started, and they were missing it. So they all freaked out and were climbing the walls and finally broke the gates down and stormed the venue. And before we knew it, the place filled up with all these fans thinking the show had started. Meanwhile, it was the police just basically sound checking.
Okay. And since you'd lived in Egypt, was it smooth sailing there?
Well, Egypt had several problems for it. First place was I went to Egypt beforehand knowing that you really need to check things out in advance. So, of course, I went. It was at the American University, which I figured was a decent hall, which it was. And, okay, do you have electricity? Does it work? Yeah, okay, the electricity works. Do you have spotlights? Yeah, okay, there are the spotlights. Okay, you've got spotlights. And so I vetted the place, and I thought, well, okay, we're pretty together. So we went, the first show was in India, then we came into Egypt. Well, I had made a mistake, or somehow the wires got crossed. And the first thing that happened was the equipment came in on air freight as opposed to excess baggage. And so I go to pick up the equipment so we can do the show that night. And of course, there's no equipment there because it came in on the freight as opposed to excess baggage. And I had a little fix-it man by the name of Muhammad. And I said, Muhammad, what are we going to do? The equipment is not here. They said, well, maybe it is it air freight. So we go to the air freight place, which, of course, was a Friday. And it was their holiday, their religious holiday, like our Sunday. And there was a guy there. He says, sorry, impossible. We cannot help you. Come back Monday, you know. I said, well, we can't. Monday, the show is tonight, you know. And Muhammad, what are we going to do? He says, I cannot help. This is impossible. Monday cannot help unless you know someone in the government, you know. And I said, well, I do remember a guy my father told me about and who's our neighbor when we lived in Egypt. I heard that he was a big deal in the government. So I do know him. He says, well, what's his name? I said, Hassan Tuhaini. You know this man? He is the vice prime minister of Egypt. He can do anything. He is a god. I said, well, get him on the phone. Lo and behold, he does get him on the phone. And I get this vice prime minister on the phone, and he's going, Mr. Goldman, how are you? How's your family? Your mother? How's your father? It's all good? Everything? You know, I said, yeah, well, it's all good, but I got a problem here. I can't get my equipment. It's in freight, and there's nobody working here. And he says, don't worry. I sent someone immediately. No more than 10 minutes went by. Sirens wailing, 20 policemen show up. They wave the equipment through, and I'm a hero. I got the equipment out. And I looked at Sting, and I said, Sting, that's management for you. Then that night, though, of course, then I showed you just how stupid manager I really was. Okay, so we get ready, and we're just doing the sound check, you know, and I'm saying, okay, well, I want the spotlights on. They said, oh, study, Mr. Goblin, I cannot do this. What do you mean? There's the spotlights. Can you turn the spotlight on so we can have? No, but there's no bulbs. So what do you mean there's no bulbs? He says, we have the spotlight, but there's no bulbs in the spotlights. And I said, well, go get some. He says, but we don't have, there's none in Egypt. We have to go to Europe to get some. What? You mean you got, you told me there were spotlights. He says, yes, we have spotlights. I said, but there's no bulbs in them. He said, no, there's no bulbs. So we actually had that. We had a film crew with us. So we had to have the sun guns from the film crew. And that was just the start of our problem. So we had not a lot of light for the show. But of course, then of course, who turns up with the chief of Cairo police with his wife and his two kids? And he's in his suit and she's all decked out and all her jewelry and her finery. And of course, what's he want? He wants the front row. And I'm saying to him, so excuse me, sir, but you know, really don't, it's a rock concert. You don't want to be at the front row because, you know, you're going to get mobbed by fans who are going to want to, you know, be close to the band. I said, you really want to be like, you know, 20 rows back or someplace, you know, someplace safe. No. I must have the front row. Okay, I warned you. Sure enough, 1 minute into the show, kids are rushing the stage. The whole place is bedlam. The chief of police is fighting people off, trying to protect his wife and his kids. And Sting takes umbrage at this and kind of walks over and sticks his foot out on the chief of police and taps him on the shoulder and says, you know, stop that, you know, because he was. And of course, that's a huge insult in Egypt. So Next thing I know, I'm standing on the side of the stage, and all these policemen and the chief of police comes rushing up to the side of the stage, and they're telling me, "This girl, he go to jail. We take him to jail." You know, I said, "Well, what happened?" It's the chief of police. And my Muhammad, my fixer guy, says, "Mr. Goblin, Sting has just hit the chief of police. He's going to be in jail tonight. You must do something, you know." So I have to have an apology, you know. So I waited for the song, Dan. I walk out on stage and I say, "Sting, you just kicked the chief of police at Cairo. He wants to put you in jail. You've got to apologize." And Sting looks at me and says, "No." I said, "Sting, for Christ's sake, you got to apologize." "No." He said he shouldn't have done that. You know. So I go back, I wait for the next song, and I go back out against Sting. "Look, this is serious. You're going to be in jail tonight in Cairo, and I don't know if I can get you out. So I'll tell you what, let me do the talking. I'll apologize, and I'll look at you, and you just nod your head like you're agreeing with me. Okay, will you do that?" He says, "Okay, I'll do that." So at the end of the show, the police are on the side of the stage. They rush out to grab Sting, and I'm right there in front of them, and I'm going, "Mr., I'm so sorry," and I'm remembering every bit of Arabic I could think of. You know, I apologize, and it shouldn't have happened. You know, everything I could think of, you know. And then I would look at Sting and say, "Sting, you know, give him the sign." And he nodded in agreement, you know. And then I'd look back at the chief of police. And so the bluff worked. And at the end of it, the chief of police turns to me and says, "I don't like that man, but you are honorable. I go now." And out he left. And I went up to Sting, and I went up to Sting, and I said, "Sting, I just saved you from a fate worse than death." That was our story of Cairo.
Let's go back to the beginning of the police's career. Legend has it that you made a unique deal with A&M where there was no upfront money, but you got a better royalty rate. What really went down there?
Well, it's true. I did make a deal with A&M for no money and a very high royalty rate. But it was not necessarily because I was being so brilliant, you know, and it was really a matter of I had no choice. I knew one thing. And that is that the police had very little going for them that I could go to a record company and try to talk them into a record deal. There was no tour upcoming. There was no press. There was no fan base. There was literally nothing. As a matter of fact, the police were sort of shunned by the punks because they were older. And they were not recognized by the older bands either. So basically, the police were in no man's land. There was nothing to recommend them except for one thing. The music they made in the studio was great, which also had Roxanne. So I knew the music had to speak for itself. So I figured if I went to the record label and I said, "Look," you know, and I set up a scenario where he only listened to the music and made a judgment based on whether he liked the music or not, and not at the back of his head was, you know, "What's this going to cost me? You know, is this going to eat up my budget for the year? What's my boss going to think? You know, suppose this fails, am I going to look like a fool?" All the sort of negatives that an average A&R guy would be having, I had to eliminate. So he'd only listen to the music. So I went in and I said, "Look, I got nothing to recommend this group, except I got amazing music. So I want to make you a deal. I'm giving you the record for free. It's yours. You don't have to negotiate. Just give me the highest royalty you can. It's free. Now, listen to the record." And I put on the record. And of course, he heard Roxanne and all the songs. And that police album was a great album. And I bet you it was the only time he ever listened to music without anything worrying him in the back of his mind about whether, you know, this might lose his job or eat up his budget for the year or whatever. He just listened to the music. And it was one of those things where it's like, you know, what do you got to lose? There was nothing. There was nothing to lose. And that sort of strategy was one that it worked. If I had asked for money, I'm sure he would have said no.
So you make a deal. Do they put the record out in the UK? What happens?
Well, the British part of the deal was, "Look, you'll put the single out in America," but I don't know if that ever really happened, to tell you the truth. But they did put the single out in England. So Roxanne came out, but it didn't really get a lot of attention. Like I was saying, you know, it wasn't a lot really going for the police. So I decided that the only really way I could get something to happen for them was to make something happen in the USA where nobody knew who they were. So my brother Ian had gotten a job at the Paragon Agency, which was a booking agency in Macon, Georgia. And being in Macon, Georgia, they felt they were always sort of feeling like they were off the beaten track, and to get a British group or something would be something special to them. So I called Ian and I said, "Look, do you think you can book the police for a tour of America? I don't care where we play, just can you get us some shows?" And he said, well, it's going to be tough. You've got no record deal and there's nobody supporting you and all that. And I said, yes, there's only three guys and a roadie. Literally, we can get by on a station wagon and a few hundred bucks a night, we can make it work. Because Laker Airways has got $75 tickets to America. So it's only going to cost a few hundred bucks to get them there. Can you get me shows? And he said, well, I'll try. And lo and behold, he gets 5 weeks of gigs, all in dumps. I mean, worst venues you could think of. I mean, CBGB's was famous, but it was a dump, you know. The Rat Club in Boston, and well-named, I might add, you know. And they played places where, you know, who knows what they were. They were discotheques or whatever. But he managed to get shows. But the funny thing was, the show that he did in Syracuse was on a cold night, and only four people showed up. I mean, after all, it was a group nobody had ever heard of. Why should they show up, you know, some club? And four people show up, and the police decide, you know, well, you know what? Four people actually bought tickets, and here in the Syracuse, nobody knows who we are. So you know what? Let's go out and give them a great show. So out they went. They did a killer show. And one of those four people turned out to be a DJ at MIT University back in Boston who had a radio show. And he was so enamored with the group that would walk out and do that, that he started, they gave him the Roxanne single that they had pressed up in England. And he started banging that on the station. And next thing you know, some other stations picked up on it. And it became a regional hit in the whole Northeast. And in January, Jerry Moss, who was always looking at, you know, the M of A&M Records, was looking at Billboard, as all the record people do. They look on the radio charts at the back pages of Billboard magazine, which is the sort of the music business magazine. And he saw that one of the biggest imports was the Police, and it had A&M Records next to it. So he knew me from the past, so he called me up, and he said, Miles, is this my band? Is this Police? It says A&M Records. Does that mean it's in America too? And I said, yeah, it is. He said, well, you're the top add-on on Northeast Radio. You know, and I said, well, let's do something. He said, well, let's get the band over here again. We'll put the record out. I said, fantastic. So I called my brother Ian again. I said, Ian, okay, the record company's now behind us. Get us a tour. Can you book us another tour? And sure enough, about 2 months later, the Police head off to America again for our second tour, this time with A&M backing. And that was really the start of the Police in America. But it was that, you know, I often get asked by people, you know, what was the most important show you ever did? And they would imagine I would say something like, you know, Shea Stadium, you know, 80,000 people that sold out in a few minutes. And I said, no. The most important show the Police ever did was to four people in Syracuse on that first tour. It just so happened that one of those four people happened to be important.
Okay, so the legend on the Police is they did not like each other. Sometimes stronger hated each other. A, was that true? And B, was that true from the beginning?
The story of the Police really is this, is that it was an interesting dynamic. There were three threes. There was the three brothers, Stuart, Ian, and I, each playing a different role. Stuart created the Police. He came up with a name. It was his idea. He always thought it was his band. Sting wrote the hit songs and was the look. And Andy was a great player, and he was sort of a peacemaker between them, you know. So I think there was always some sort of, let's say, I wouldn't quite call it animosity, but Stuart looked at it as his band, but he also knew that Sting was really the driver of it. I as the manager, Ian as the agent, we all had a big part to play. So it was a combination of forces that were making the Police happen. It wasn't singly Stuart, or it wasn't singly Sting, you know. So a lot of the thing about that they were hated was exaggerated because it made a better story. I remember the first documentary on the Police. You know, I was interviewed, and they asked the same question you just asked: did the Police really hate each other? And I said, well, no, actually, there was tension, of course. You know, because in a band that's happening and as crazy as it was, you know, yeah, there was tension, but no, there was no hatred there. There was sort of a there were times, like, for instance, when Stuart got so excited, he squeezed Sting a little hard and he cracked his rib, you know. That was not because he hated Sting. That was because he was so excited, you know. And I said, but, you know, I sort of downplayed the whole idea of the Police hating each other. Well, when the documentary comes out, I'm hardly in it. And I'm looking at the documentary and I'm seeing guys in there that I didn't even know. who seemed to be experts on the police. And they were saying things, oh, yeah, you know, Sting and Stewart hate each other. And, oh, yeah, they're always in each other's throat. And I'm going, I went to the MTV people and I said, what are you doing? That's not true. And they said, well, it makes a better story. And the fact of the matter is, I'm probably the least, I knew more than anyone other than the three band members, but I'm in the least in the video because I was not telling what they wanted to hear. It's a better story that they hated each other. You know, later years, there was probably a bit more animosity because when they did the reunion tour, I mean, I hear this, that Sting wanted to change some of the songs and change the chords, and Stewart didn't really like it. So maybe there was more animosity later on. But during the police years, you know, from what I saw, was there tension? Was there, you know, naturally there would be, but there was no hatred.
So how do three Copeland brothers, the father and intelligence, all end up in the music business?
By a complete fluke, you know. And, I mean, it's one of the things that, I mean, I just wrote a book, my memoirs, which I actually just today placed with a publisher. So it'll be out in 3 or 4 more months, you know. And I explain this, but it's one of the curious stories that, you know, here I was, I knew nothing about the music business. And I met a group in London, in Beirut, who said, look, we think you can help us. And I go to London, and on my way to report to the U.S. Army, because I just got drafted, and they came to me and said, we want you to be our manager. And I said, well, I'd love to, but crazy idea, but I'm drafted, you know. So I went off to America, got rejected by the U.S. Army because I have high arches, you know. I wasn't even trying to get out of the Army, but they rejected me. I was one of 2,000 people, the only one to get rejected. So I felt, in a way, sort of bad about it, except that it was Vietnam time, and all my friends were trying to figure a way to get out of the Army, and I had inadvertently got out of it. But I sent a cable back to London saying, well, I'm out of the Army. I get a cable back from this group that I ended up managing that said, God bless your feet. Anyway, the group became Wishbone Ash, which was the first group I ever managed. And it was really a lark. I went back to London. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had imagined I was going to be 2 years in the Army. And they said, we think you can help us. And, you know, why not? You know, and I just said, what the hell? And next thing I knew, I was in the music business.
Okay, you were learning on the fly. You're obviously a smart guy, but you must have made big mistakes.
Well, I think, you know, one of the great lessons of life is you can learn things from mistakes, maybe even more than from successes, you know. I sure made mistakes. But the one thing I knew that I know what I like. So it was not something where I was always looking over my shoulder to say, well, you know, how do I know it's any good? Well, you know, my view was I like it, so it must be good, you know. And that was really, it was as simple as that. And it was not a time where it was, let's say, there were no classes in university to go learn how to be a rock and roll manager, you know. So most managers were learning on the fly, you know. And who's to know what makes something work and something not work? You know, this has always been a mystery, you know. And it's not just money, you know. There are a lot of people that have tons of money to try to make something happen. It doesn't happen. But I knew what I liked. And I guess I didn't have the feeling that I was worse or better than anybody else. So why not? And I kind of just went out and did it. And being in England, where a lot of the attitudes in England at that time were, you know, I would call it a glass half full country, you know, where I'd look at a glass half full and I'd say I would put that another way. They're a glass half empty country, whereas I was a glass half full country. We could look at the same glass. They would say, well, it's empty. And I would say, well, it's full. So I basically just said, well, I don't know what I'm not supposed to know. So let's just go out and do it. And I would dream up ideas. And with one of my first stunts, I went to trying to find a show. I had no idea how to get a show going, you know. And down the road from where I was staying with my parents, there was a college that had put on shows. And I went down there and called them up and said, look, could I get an opening slot for the show? And that was kind of put off. And so I decided to go to the college myself. So I went to the college. I met the person organizing the show as one of the students. And I said, well, I've got the opening act on the show. And they go, oh, well, okay, we don't know about that, but if you say so. So, and then I went back to the group and I said, look, just show up because the college thinks you're on, you know. And then the headline group they showed up and they thought the college had booked the opening act. So the college thought the headline act had booked the opening act, and the headline act thought the college had booked the act. And meanwhile, Wishbone Ash go on to do the show, and nobody said anything wiser. Of course, we didn't get paid, but they played a show. So it was stuff like that. He was just doing it, you know. And that kind of got the ball rolling.
Did you get Wishbone Ash their record deal?
Yeah.
How'd you do that?
Well, that was something where we did I was so desperate to get shows, but I really had no clue how to do it. And I saw on the back pages of one of the music papers that there was a little book, and it said The Booker's Bible. And for £25, which was a reasonable amount of money at that time, because the average wage was something like £19 that period, you know, so a week. So I thought, well, a Booker's Bible, which had every name in it. So I called up the phone number, and sure enough, the guy that answered says, yes, it's got every phone number you could possibly want with all the clubs and all everybody that books shows. And the guy sounded kind of crooked, you know, and I thought, well, you know, I'll think about it. And he said, look, I'll tell you what, I'll show you how the book works. He's paying the £25. I'll show you how it works. I'll come to your house and let's get a phone and I'll show you how the book works. And I thought, well, you know, I'm desperate. I have no clue. And the band's rehearsing and getting ready to do shows, and they're going to be asking me soon, when's our first gig? And I had no gigs, you know. So I figured, well, okay, I'll bring this guy over. So I get this guy. And of course, he looks just like the crook that he sounded like on the phone. And he books some shows. Of course, first show comes around, and off goes the group to the show. And of course, there's no show. And I call him up and say, look, there's no club where you said there was, you know. Oh, you got the wrong address. And he gives me another address. The group goes to that. Of course, no show. So now I'm thinking, okay, all the shows in the book that he had booked, because we had like 8 shows in the books, they all must be phony or something's wrong. So I start calling all the places. Sure enough, everyone was like, no, we only booked discos, or no, we don't have music groups here anymore. And everyone was a no-show. So I thought, oh, my God. Now I was so embarrassed that I actually decided, you know, I mean, cold calling is a terribly hard thing to do. Just get on the phone and start calling somebody, you know. And I decided, well, I was so embarrassed that I knew that when the group came over to do rehearsals that I would have to tell them the bad news that all the shows they thought were in the books were gone. So I got on and I started using this book. Well, lo and behold, a lot of the numbers were good. And I started booking. I actually booked 3 shows, one of which was a show which was opening for Deep Purple in a place just outside of London. And Ritchie Blackmore, the guitarist of Deep Purple, saw Wishbone Ash and thought they were pretty good, and mentioned it to a producer friend of his, who then called me up and said, look, I'd like to produce your group. So that's how I met Derek Lawrence, who ended up producing the first Wishbone Ash album. So it's really Ritchie Blackmore from Deep Purple who had put his producer on it and who called me. And what did I know? But sounded like a decent producer. And he said he could get me a record deal, and he did. He got a deal with MCA Records.
And why wasn't the band bigger in the U.S.?
I think really it was because they never really wrote that hit song. And their vocals were never really killer. They were a good workman-like group. And their disadvantage was that they, you know, really to make a hit in America, you can have a lot of bands that are great, but if they don't have that hit song that gets all over the radio, they're just never really going to make it, you know. And Wishbone never really had that killer song. I mean, they had some songs that worked in New Orleans, for instance, or this town or that town, but overall, it just never was an act that had that winning song. And the vocals were okay. You know, the musicianship was great, but that really wasn't enough to make them a big, big deal. It made them an okay deal, you know. But I learned a lot. You know, it took me out across the country. I did shows all over America. I got involved with other groups. So I would say they were a learning experience. And I valued that. And it came to be a great bunch of lessons that I applied to the Police in the later years.
So how'd you get involved with the Climax Blues Band?
That was a band that I had heard records of them, and they had a great guitar player, and they had great vocals. And I was in England, obviously, and I'd seen them advertised, but they were a band that had been around for quite a while, but it never seemed to be getting anywhere. And so I basically, as a lark, I said to them, I called them up and I said, look, I'm a manager and I would like to represent you. And I know you've never been to America before. I could take you to America. And, you don't have a manager and I think I could help you. And they basically put me off. And I kept calling them and they kept putting me off. And then one day I saw that they were playing in a local club in London. And I called them up and said, look, well, let me meet you in person at the club. And let's see if we can work something out. Well, I went down to the club. It was a place called the Marquee Club on Wardour Street in the West End of London. And I'm there. And of course, they don't, at the time they were supposed to meet, they didn't show up. And I waited an hour and they never showed up. So I said, to hell with it, to hell with them. I started walking back to my office. And I'm walking down the street. And just as I get to the street corner, a van comes whizzing by and it almost hit me, you know. And in the van was the Climax Blues Band. They thought I was sitting there on the street corner waiting for them to pass by, that I was that keen on signing them. Actually, I had said to hell with it, I was going home. But they waved and I realized it was them. So I walked back to the Marquee Club. And they were like, okay, this guy must be real. He was so keen on us, he waited on the street corner for us. So we made a deal. I became the manager.
So were you involved with them when they had their big hits, like Couldn't Get It Right and Ooh, I Love You?
Yeah, they Couldn't Get It Right was really, they had delivered an album and it had no hit on it. And I said to them, guys, you know, I can make you much bigger than you are, but you've got to have that hit song. And I don't hear it on the record. So you've got to go back to the studio. And I put up a bunch of names of songs that I thought they could cover that might work. But they were against that. And they said, well, I think we have one. And they went and they wrote Couldn't Get It Right. And we went in the studio and cut that. And when I heard it, I realized that was the song that we needed. And of course it was. It went to number 3 in America and I think at number 5 in England. And that was the first big hit they had. So I do take some credit for the fact that I pushed them to come up with the hit song. And that did project them into a bigger marketplace. But by that time, I was always having my own troubles financially. And we ended up parting ways. And later on, they had the song I Love You, which I was not part of.
Okay. Tell me more about these financial troubles.
Partly because Wishbone Ash was a group that couldn't really, I mean, they were not going to come up with a hit song. They were really going to make it live. And most of the bands I was working with, including Climax Blues Band, were great live bands where, you know, you're dealing with an audience and what's live is a bit different than a hit single on the radio, you know. So I figured if I could make the band succeed through big concerts, then that would get them to be big enough, you know, that would break them wide open. And one of the markets where we were had not really broken yet was Europe. And so I dreamed of this idea that if I could put Wishbone Ash on with some other big acts and make it look like Wishbone was a headliner, and we go do all these festivals in Europe, and I go spend the money to hire, you know, Lou Reed and John McLaughlin and all these various acts that we were working with, we were thinking about, that I could make Wishbone Ash and Climax and the other bands I was working with look good. And in concept, it was sort of a Lollapalooza tour before Lollapalooza. Conceptually, it was great and it worked. The problem was a lot of the technicalities of it were difficult and very expensive. And pretty soon I was cleaned out of money. I just didn't have the money to finance something like this. I mean, we hired 2 planes. And we go load up the equipment on the airplanes, you know. And I was thinking, isn't that great? We got our own planes, you know. The pilot shows up, realizes the plane's super overweight with all the equipment. He says, get that shit off my plane, you know. That was the start of our troubles. I had to hire trucks to carry the equipment to the next show and one thing after another. Then Lou Reed didn't show up. So we were trying to find out what happened to Lou Reed. And turns out he was in Australia, you know. So I called his agent, who was William Morrison at that time, and they said, "Well, we've got a phone number for you, but you have to deal with it yourself." So I finally get him in his hotel room in Australia. And his friend, Rachel, answers the phone. I said, hi, it's Miles Copeland. I wanted to know when Lou Reed's going to show up because, you know, the dates are in a week. We need to know when we can pick him up at the airport. And all that. Well, Lou doesn't know about the tour. I said, well, what do you mean he doesn't know about the tour? I said, can I talk to Lou? He said, well, he's in the bathroom. I said, well, I'll wait. And Rachel says, well, he's been here for 3 days, so it's going to be a long wait. But what do you mean 3 days? Well, he's been in there 3 days and he won't come out. So I knew by then we were in deep trouble. Of course, Lou Reed never showed up. He had fired the agent beforehand, apparently. So I had to scamper around and find, we finally found Ike and Tina Turner to do the shows in his place. But of course, we were trying to book them at the last minute. So of course the price tag went up. Anyway, I got cleaned out. I was on the verge of bankruptcy. And that was really the start of me. I mean, I lost everything. I my brother Stuart was in Curved Air, and Climax Blues Band eventually left, Wishbone left, everybody left because I had no money, you know. But that was when the punks were coming along and nobody paid attention to them and they had no money. So I knew what I was doing and had no money, and they didn't know what they were doing and had no money. So we were like destined to be together.
So what was your next move with the punks?
Well, I realized that there were, you know, you couldn't help but pick up a British newspaper, which was the National Press, and the punks, you know, the Sex Pistols, they were all over the newspapers, you know. But the music press just shunned them, you know. And I kept thinking, well, you know, they're all over the press and there's all this craziness and nobody pays attention to them and everybody says they're losers. You know, maybe I can help, you know. And it just so happened that Malcolm McLaren, the manager of the Sex Pistols, had an office above where I was working. I had gone back to an old office friend of mine that had loaned me his office. And I said, you know, can I come into your office? And I needed a place to work. And Malcolm McLaren was upstairs. So I'd go upstairs and say, Malcolm, I've been reading in the papers that no one will book the Sex Pistols. But, you know, I called a friend of mine at the Marquee Club and he'll book the Sex Pistols. Oh, I'm sorry, Miles. No, we can't do it. The Pistols are busy that day. So I'd go back downstairs. I called the Marquee Club. I said, look, you know, give me another date. So three or four times I did this. And fourth time I went up to Malcolm, I said, okay, I got like three more shows, and can you do any of these? Finally, he jumps up and starts screaming at me. Don't you get it? I get more press saying they can't get gigs than you're screwing up my whole rap. Get the fuck out of my office. So I'm kind of like stunned. I mean, but the papers say you can't, no one will book the group. I just booked them. And as I'm walking out, I had had a call from a promoter in Holland saying, I'll book the Sex Pistols. So as I'm walking out, I said, okay, Malcolm, I get it. Okay. But I do have a gig in Holland. I don't know if you'd be interested in that. He said, oh, Holland, I'll do that. I said, oh, okay. Well, I'll do Holland. He says, but I can't go. So you'll have to take the group. So I take the Sex Pistols. I do the first shows out of England in Holland at the place called the Paradiso. And I go off with Johnny Rotten and the gang. This is before Sid Vicious joined the group. And I go off with the Sex Pistols, which, of course, gave me a great credibility with all the punks. Next thing I know, Billy Idol and all these punk bands are knocking at the door saying, well, can you book shows for us? You know. So before I knew it, all of a sudden I was the guy you went to if you wanted to book a show for a punk group. So Susie and the Banshees and Billy Idol was a band called Generation X at the time. And then it was a magazine called Sniffing Glue, which was run by a guy named Mark Perry. And he comes into the office to do an interview with one of the bands. And next thing I know, he's moved into the office. So all of us, before I knew it, my office was Sniffing Glue's office. And of course, that meant all the punk groups came there. And next thing I know, I'm in the punk world, you know, which was fine.
Are you a manager? Are you a promoter? What's your role?
I'm a bit of everything, you know, with some I'm managing and some I'm a promoter and some I'm a, you know, and then I had friends in New York. I called an old manager friend of mine who was a publicist that I'd used with Wishbone and Climax called Jane Friedman, who was working with Patti Smith and John Cale and television. And I called her and said, you've got some acts over there that might be interesting in England. You know, I think I can get some shows for them. So I brought Blondie and Television and toured them in England. And John Cale got him to England and had him produce Squeeze, who I just signed for management. And I got him to work with the Police, but they didn't get on at all, so that didn't work. But basically, before I knew it, I was becoming the kind of the main honcho in the punk world in England. So I started a label with Mark Perry called Step Forward Records, and I had Squeeze on Deptford Fun City Records, and Stuart, my brother Stuart, and Wayne County and the Electric Chairs, and different bands on Illegal Records, and I was in the punk world doing independent records, and that's really how the Police got going.
So how did that work out financially for you?
Well, because you could make a record for £80, you know, and then I'd get in my car and I'd drive to a record store and they'd buy the records. You know, they'd give you the cash right there, you know. So I was literally in the record business, where not only was I in the studio making the record, I would then take the tapes to the master room to get the master done, and then to the plate maker to make the plate, and then the label maker to get the label and the sleeve, you know, so I was doing the lot. But you could make enough that they would pay for themselves, because punks didn't really know who was who at the time. So the records, either to the record store, so they would kind of, you'd go into a store and say, well, here's my latest release, and they'd buy five boxes, you know, so it was like, well, that's great, you know. Well, it was great for about 4 or 5 months. And then finally you'd walk in and I'd say, well, here's my list. I'd say, okay, let me have a listen. How many fans have they got? Oops, the bubble had burst, you know. But it was enough to get going, you know.
Did that carry you through to the Police?
Yeah, it carried me through, where we were handling the Cramps and The Fall and Sham 69 and Chelsea, all these different kind of bands. So we were sort of buzzing around. It was all sort of small time, but in London, you know, that you could be kind of small time and be successful, you know. But with the Police, you know, nobody cared. And I found a studio, or a friend of mine found a studio actually, and I could record the full album for £1,000, which, you know, today would be worth what, $5,000-$6,000. So to record the first Police, which meant, you know, that's why I could offer it for free, you know, because it really didn't cost very much. If it had been a $200,000-$300,000 deal, well, of course, you know, you needed money to do that. But the fact is that nobody needed money in those days. You could record for very little. Nobody was looking, you know, a lot of the bands could hardly play. You know, I don't, when I first saw the Clash, I wasn't sure they knew that those things at the top of the guitar were for tuning the strings, you know.
Okay. But going to the Police, what's it like working with your brother?
Well, I guess in some ways it was strange, but in some ways, you know, I'd give him his first job, you know.
Which was what?
As a tour manager for Joan Armatrady. He had just gotten out of college, and I'd said, look, I've just taken on this act. Would you be the tour manager? And off he goes to America with Joan Armatrady. And then later, when he comes back, I had just signed up a violin player by the name of Daryl Way, who had a group called Curved Air. And they were looking for a drummer. And to cut a long story short, you know, Daryl figured, well, if Stuart's in the band and he's Miles's brother, Miles will probably pay more attention to it. So Stuart gets a gig in Curved Air. And Curved Air goes out and is reasonably successful. Well, they were another casualty of the big fatal tour I did in Europe, you know, the Star Trekking tour, which was a disaster and put me near bankruptcy. So that's when Stuart decided that, you know, all this highfalutin bands with lots of equipment and roadies and God knows what, let's strip it all down to the simplest possible thing. And that's when he came up with the idea of three people and one roadie and very little equipment, like all the punks, basically, which meant that for a guy like me who had no money, you know, you could actually do, and they were not precious about having to be in big famous studios or whatever else. So when I said, I can record your album for £1,000, they were game. They had nothing to lose.
And then what comes first, ERG, A Music War, or IRS?
IRS came first, because when I got to England with the Police and they started happening, I had a lot of bands back in England were saying, well, what about us? You know, we want to have a little shot in America too, you know. So I figured that I needed to find a way to get their records out in America. I mean, I was bringing them as imports and selling them at some of the import stores, but that really wasn't satisfying any of the acts. So I went to Jerry Moss and I said, well, I figured A&M is already sort of on side in a sense. I mean, they were sort of fans in a way. And since the Police didn't cost them a lot of money, and they kind of figured I was onto something, but they didn't know quite what yet. So I went into Jerry Moss and I said, I'll tell you what, I've got these bands in England and I'm going to make you the same kind of deal I made for the Police in the beginning. I don't need your money. I just need you to put the records out. So I'm going to give you the records for free and you give me a label and let your own salespeople decide, you know, how many they're going to press up. Let them vet the thing. I mean, it's down to you, not the, you know, so there's no risk. And he said, okay, well, sounds fair enough. Let me hear the records. I said, that's the only caveat. I said, you can't hear the music. I said, you have to put out whatever I give you, but your own salespeople can tell you how many you should press up. You know, if they want to press up five, no problem. But you can't listen to the music. Because I knew if he heard the music, if he heard the Buzzcocks and he heard Chelsea and he heard, he would say no. So lo and behold, he said, okay, I'll give you the deal. And then I went out and signed the Buzzcocks. The good news was the bands like the Buzzcocks and later the, you know, a lot of the punk bands could not get deals in America. So if somebody came along to them and said, look, I'll put your record out in America, but I can't pay you money, I'll give you a good royalty. A lot of them said, okay, that sounds good to me. So I was signing up bands for next to nothing. And I didn't need a lot. And the Police were beginning to make a little bit of money at this time. So I didn't need a lot of money to launch a label. And, you know, the Cramps had songs they'd already recorded. The Buzzcocks, I picked up the record that had already been recorded in England. And I kind of went down the list and picked up bands that nobody else was interested in that couldn't get deals in America. And A&M gave me a label. And my first employee, as another sort of example, is my first employee was somebody that had just gotten fired, actually, from the A&M College Department. And I knew I couldn't afford any money. So I said, I'll tell you what, I'll make you vice president of the label, which for a college kid was like a big deal. But I can only pay you $100 a week. I figured all his friends would think he was crazy, but he did it. And he ended up becoming a big deal in the record business. So,
who was that?
It was a guy named Jay Boberg, you know.
Right.
But it was really a matter of making things so cheap that the answer had to be yes. I mean, that was part of my sales pitch was, look, if you make the answer an easy yes, you're likely to get a yes. If Jay had said to me, well, I need $50,000 a year salary or I'm not doing it, I would have said, well, hell with you. I'm not hiring you. You know, if I'd gone to Jerry Moss and said, look, I got all these acts in England, and I need $100,000 to launch a label, he would have said, get the fuck out of my office, you know. If I'd gone into the A&M guy in England and said, look, I got this big, great band of Police, but I need X, you know, they would have said, sorry, mate, no deal, you know. So a lot of the best deals I ever made were for no money up front. But that opened the door. It made it easy for somebody to say yes.
And what were the first records that got the notice of A&M that were on IRS?
Well, actually, after the first year, you would have thought, yeah, I mean, the Buzzcocks did 25,000 albums, which actually made a profit for A&M. You know, not a lot, but at least it was a profit, you know. The Cramps sold a bit, and the Wall of Voodoo and whatever, you know. But none of them were really big hits, of any course. So Jerry Moss calls me into his office and says, Miles, sorry to tell you this, but let's close the label. You haven't had a hit. You put out 8 records, and they haven't had any hits. I said, but Jerry, did you make money out of IRS in the first year? He said, yeah, well, but not a lot, you know. I said, yeah, but you made a profit, right? He said, yes, that's true. And I said, how many deals have you ever done in your career in the music business? Unless you remember, this is the guy that had the Carpenters and Peter Frampton and a huge list of acts, one of the most respected labels in America. I said, how many deals have you ever done in your career in which the first year you made money on the deal? He said, well, actually, probably none. I said, yes, but you made money on my deal, didn't you? He said, yeah, but not. I said, yes. And I said, let me ask you another question. I said, how many records does the normal act have before they really break big and become a major act? He said, well, it's usually the third album. And I said, well, I put out 8 records, yes, but every one was the first album of the act. None of those acts have got to album 3. He says, yeah, you're right. Okay, I'll give you another year. So IRS carried on for another year. At the end of that year, we signed the Go-Go's. And shortly thereafter, the Go-Go's went to number 1 in the U.S. charts. The first girl group to ever have a number 1 album in America, where they played the music themselves and wrote all the songs. So it was our first number 1. It was the biggest album of the year. It was a momentous event, actually. And Showtime just had a documentary out on the Go-Go's, actually, which kind of goes through the importance of that record. But the funny thing about the Go-Go's was I was the only person at any of the shows willing to sign this group.
And was it directly done by you?
Yeah, I signed them. And it was not for, I mean, there was money involved, but it was not a lot. I mean, I couldn't have afforded the major deals that people were doing, you know. So they had to be reasonable because there was no place else to go. Their manager had come and gotten a deal with me. And I said, look, I want to sign the group. She went back to the only other label that had registered, you know, what looked like might be interest, which was Elektra Records. And Elektra said, no, we're not signing girl groups. So she had no place to go. She came back to me and said, okay, we'll sign with you. And I went in and negotiated the deal. And it was, you know, more than I wanted to spend, but a lot less than they thought they deserved. And I signed the group. And I mean, to me, you know, 5 girls who sang, who played well and had energy and were enthusiastic. And that just seemed like a great marketing thing to me. You know, I mean, how bad could it be? Of course, I had no idea the album would go to number 1. You know, I figured, you know, top 40 would be good, you know, but it just seemed to me a winner. But all the other labels went by the rules. They said, well, there's never been a girl group that had a big hit record, so we don't want to sign a girl group. They never even heard the music. And that was sort of how I built IRS. I went with what I listened to, and I thought, you know, that's good. I'll sign it.
And who decided that Richard Goddard would produce that record?
I decided that. I had met Richard when he was producing the Climax Blues Band. And he did the Blondie album, which I toured in England. So I had known Richard from the Sire Records days. And I knew he was unlike the average producer in that he was kind of new school in that he had just done Blondie, but he was also a songwriter. His career started as a songwriter. So I knew he knew the mechanics of a hit song. And I felt the Go-Go's had songs, you know, and he just seemed to be the right sensibility for me. And I talked him into doing it at a price much less than he would normally get. But that's all I had, really. I didn't have the money. You know, I just said, Richard, can you do the album for this price? And he wasn't sure. And I said, well, let me send you the group, and I think you're going to like them, you know. And he did, and he recorded them. But, of course, he went over budget, and he went about $7,000 over budget, calls me and says, Miles, I'm over budget, $7,000. I need you to send me the money. And I said, Richard, I'm sorry. I don't have the money. And I said, you better hope the record sells because that's the only way you're going to get your money back. So luckily for him, the record sold.
Okay, and then how does Urga Music War, the movie, come to be?
Well, I was at the time becoming the, I guess, IRS and the Police, and we were sort of at the bandwagon of the, you know, at the front of the vanguard of the whole new music scene. So when Michael White, the producer, had this idea about doing a movie, he called me up and said, would you be interested in helping me produce this movie? I want to make a movie about all these great, fun little groups that are going on around the world. And it's just going to be a movie about, you know, we just film each of the groups. There's no real storyline or whatever. And I said, well, sure. You know, for me, it was another way I was figuring, you know, I want to get exposure for these people, you know, because the radio was still not totally on board yet, you know, and MTV hadn't started yet. And, you know, any way we could get exposure to me was, hey, if you'll give me exposure, hey, I'm your guy, you know. So I said, sure, I'll help you. And of course, I roped in the Police and all the bands I was working with, plus all sorts of other bands, you know, to give it credibility. We got as many bands as we could. So Erg was basically, Michael White had the idea and he got the money together and I got the bands together.
And you got the record.
Yeah. I got A&M to put the record out. I didn't, it became an A&M record. I mean, again, there was some money involved. And at the time I didn't have any money. So I gave it to A&M.
Let's go back to the Police. Police are relatively unique in that every album was bigger than the previous one, and they were all successful. During this run, did you ever go back to A&M and renegotiate?
Yes and no. Okay, first place, your first statement is incorrect, okay, in America. Okay, the first record went out and did very well. The second record was released in America and did three quarters of what the first one did. So it was not as successful. In England, the opposite happened. The first record was released in England and just almost disappeared without a trace. The second album went straight to number one. And it was complete bedlam in England. Okay. It was, you know, we had three number one hit singles in a row. So England and Europe was completely different to America. America was a slow build. It wasn't till the fifth album that the Police had a number one record in America. And that became the Synchronicity, and you know, that became the biggest album. But the second album was not the biggest. I think the first album went out and did like 500,000. Second album did, you know, 300,000. You know, it takes time to build America, you know. But in England, it was quick. The second album just went gangbusters. Crazy, you know. And in Europe, it was the same, a lot of around the world. So the Police were really big around the world, faster than they were in America. So you had to have a different strategy in each part of the world, which is part of the reason why I went around the world with the Police, because I knew that those photographs would do well in places like Europe, Japan, Australia, whatever it is. It would help in America. But in America, it's really, you know, you're battling station by station by station by station. You know, it's part of the problem of our system in America. You know, how many national radio stations are there, you know? Well, you know, there aren't really, you know. So it was a ladder of, okay, you could be big in Boston, but you'd be unknown in L.A., you know. So America takes its time. Whereas in England, you get on the BBC and you've got the whole country day one, you know. So and a lot of European countries are the same way. You know, you have one national station pretty much covers the country, whereas in America, it's a much slower build.
Yeah, so what about renegotiating?
Okay, as far as renegotiating, of course. After it wasn't until the second or third record, though. Well, actually, the second record became huge in England. And I had a lawyer who was a very famous lawyer called Alan Grubman. And he always figured, well, you know, his famous quote was, it's not about the money, it's about the money. So his view was, if you can renegotiate, go get the money. The hell with the royalty. You know, just get the money. So it wasn't long before, you know, we went in and renegotiated. And I think we probably renegotiated on every album, you know, to get a bit more royalty points. And sure, we got higher royalty points and we got more money and all that. And the Police did very well, you know. But often I think back and I think, well, what really is the smartest strategy? Because there was an opposite strategy, which I was uniquely aware of, and that was the REM strategy. I signed REM for $25,000 because my brother Ian had met them he was in Macon, Georgia, and they were in Athens, Georgia. And he told me and he said, look, you got to sign this group, you know. And so I signed them, you know. And they developed a lot of fans in the company. And every record did more than the last. Next record was, you know, 75,000. Next record was 150,000. And it kept creeping up. And every advance would go higher. And as we began to realize, this was a group that was going places, you know. They'd call them in the office and speak to the manager and say, look, we'd like to give you more money and per record. And increase your royalties, and in return, you know, give us a couple more records at the end of the deal. And their response was, well, look, we're fine. You know, we got enough money. We don't need any more. We're happy with the deal as it is. So you know what? We'll just do the deal and we'll go through the contract. And at the end of the deal, we'll come to you and say, well, we're open now. And, you know, we'll wait for an offer from you and from the open market and we'll see what happens. And he said, but, you know, we love your company and, you know, we're open for anything, you know, but no, we don't need. So I couldn't renegotiate. So the next record went out, was bigger. And, you know, we got to the last album and I'm thinking, we're going to lose REM, you know. So, of course, try to renegotiate. Look, we'll even give you, we'll backdate the royalties, you know. We'll give you back your masters, you know. No, we're fine. Meanwhile, of course, the Police renegotiated every time. And then Sting, when I was managing Sting, renegotiated his contract every time. And, you know, he made more and more money. I made more money, you know. But then REM go off and the deal's over. And they come to me and say, well, the deal's over. We love your, you know, we love IRS. So we're going to the marketplace and you can make an offer like everybody else. And we're going to go with the best offer. So the money went up and up. And, you know, I got to a point, it was $3 million. And it was like, that was about as far as I could go. And I went to Jerry Moss and he said, well, I'll help you. I'll put up a couple million, you know. And the group comes in and says, well, we've just been to Warner Brothers and they're offering more than that. And I went back to Jerry and I said, Jerry, we're going to lose REM. Can you up the offer? And he said, we're at $5 million. I mean, we can't go more than that, you know. And they want their masters back. He said, I can't do that. So I brought the managers back in again. And they're very honorable guys. I have to admit, they were really good people. And they said, look, Miles, we've just been back to Warner Brothers. And here's what they just told us. And here's the letter contract. And they said, whatever Miles offers you, we'll pay you double. And I said, guys, I looked at that paper with incredulity. I looked at that thing and I said, guys, here's my advice. Get out of my office right now. Go straight to Warner Brothers. Sign that deal before they change their mind. And I got to say, that's the best deal I've ever seen. And guys, congratulations, I'm proud of you. And they left, they went to Warner Brothers, and they signed the biggest record deal in history. And then again, when that deal expired and all their rights returned and they re-signed again, they made the biggest record deal in the history of the music business. And I have to say that now when I look back at it and I say the Alan Grubin method of hitting them, renegotiate every deal and up the money and whatever, versus the REM deal. REM deal, REM made more money than the Police. A lot more. Because they ended up with total freedom to get all the rights back to their masters. And it just ended up being a phenomenal deal. They actually did do it historically the biggest record deal ever.
Okay. As a manager, how much do you charge?
In the case of the Police, we were all in it together. So we split it four ways. So everybody made 25%. And out of my 25%, I gave part of it. I gave 25% to a partner who was with the Police every single day on the road. So I was making 25 less 25. But the management commission was 25%. Management commissions historically go from 15% to 20%. Some managers take as much as 50%. And it really depends on what the manager's offering. And it depends on the negotiating position of the group, all sorts of things.
Well, you've managed a lot of bands. Do you commission the recording budget? Do you take from the net on the road? What kind of deals do you have?
I think you can't really record from the recording budget because the band doesn't receive that. I recommission what they get. Okay, I don't commission money that goes to recording studio, whatever, okay? On the concerts, you know, I commissioned the profit of the concerts, you know.
Okay. Do you still get paid on Police records?
Yes. And one of the things I was very precious about was to say, look, I am not into renting myself as a manager. If I'm going to roll up my shirt sleeves and fight for you guys, we're all in this together. So let's be in it all the way. I'm not going to be simply working for you for 5 years and then I get nothing. Although nowadays, some acts think that that's fair, you know. So if some act came to me and they were already successful so that I could bank the money, you know, that it was like a no brainer. I could say, okay, so you're going to pay me, I'm going to automatically make X million dollars a year. So, okay, you know what? After 5 years, you're free to go on your own. In that case, I would say, okay, because there's no risk. I'm going to make money. I've heard of a manager saying, well, okay, I'll manage an act and I'll make it. You pay me $1 million a year and I'll manage it. I'd say that's not a bad management deal because you're making $1 million a year. And if you're only doing it for 5 years, well, okay. But the Police, nobody wanted the Police. It was a pure risk. I invested in the first album. I paid for that first album. I paid for that first tour. Okay, so I invested in something which had almost everybody said it was a no-hoper. But all four of us were in it together. So that was really why I kept my royalty.
Did you have paper with the band?
Yeah, eventually. After we made the record deal and the record went out and started successful, we made a deal. And that's when they said, well, I have to, you know, have a partner. And I agreed, actually. I think it was only fair. I mean, I've always been someone that agreed that if you've got somebody good working with you, give them a reward more than just a salary, which is why I gave a percentage of the record company to Jay Boberg. I gave a percentage of Police. Most of the companies I've done business with, I've always given one of the key people in the company a piece of the action so that they felt that it was more than just a job, that it was their life. And that's always worked for me. I've never been afraid to give part of the, you know, the business away.
Now, A&M was ultimately sold to PolyGram, gobbled up, becomes part of Universal. Have they ever approached you to buy out your royalty stream?
Okay, they came to me when the IRS deal was coming to a close. Jerry called me in and said, look, would you be interested in selling the label? And I said, well, I'm not opposed to it, except that I'm not going to just sell it. What I would do is we'll make a financial deal, but I want you to exchange IRS shares for A&M shares. Give me shares of A&M so we're all in this together. And he agreed. He said, that sounds like a reasonable deal. Of course, I wasn't expecting, I mean, A&M was a lot bigger label than IRS was, and I wasn't expecting to walk away with half the label, but, you know, 5%, 10% of A&M would have been worth millions of dollars, you know. So a couple weeks later, I go back and I said, okay, you're ready to make an offer. So what's the offer? He says, well, I can't actually give you shares because we're a subchapter S corporation. And that means I can't give you shares in the company, but we're prepared to buy you. And he pulled out some dollar figure, which was really just not very interesting to me. And I got so angry, I stormed out of the office. And of course, Jerry and I later became very good friends. And in some ways, I wish I had figured some way to do a deal with him because when we went to MCA, it was really not quite the same. And then we went to EMI and whatever. You know, we became the corporation we really didn't want to become. But it was a lesson. I mean, I learned a lot of lessons along the way, you know, what the corporate world really is. You know, when IRS started and when the Police started, we were flying by the seat of our pants. We had nothing to lose. Everything was cheap. I could be crazy. I could sign crazy acts. And I signed a lot of crazy acts, you know. But they were ones where I could afford it, you know, and the ones that if they didn't work, too bad, you know, but it was fun on the way, you know. Whereas when you all of a sudden are part of a corporation and they're talking millions of dollars and whatever, they want to see hit records and they're not interested in whether you have an act that's cool or not. They're interested in whether you're selling records or not. And that's quite a jolt for someone like me, you know, to be thrown out of the world of doing something that's hip and cool and, you know, you're doing it for the love of the music versus you have to make numbers or they're going to fire you, you know. So that's a...
Okay, so who owns the masters of IRS today?
Well, now it's all owned by Universal.
And how did that come to be?
Well, Universal bought A&M, Universal bought MCA, Universal bought EMI, you know. So I ended up selling IRS to EMI. Because we needed the money and EMI made us a pretty nice offer and they were busy trying to build their business. And I looked at it and said, well, you know, the business has changed. It's not as fun anymore. And, you know, we've been at it long enough and it's about time that I made something out. 'Cause I never made anything out of IRS in the beginning, you know. I had staff that were getting paid, but I wasn't, you know. It was a labor of love, basically. But I was making money managing the police and Sting, you know. So I never really thought about money. But when we sold EMI, they ended up buying the label. And then, of course, Universal buys EMI, and they own the Beatles. You know, they own Frank Sinatra. They own IRS. They own the police. They own the lot.
Okay, you're on both sides of it. You've been a manager, and you've also cut royalties, meaning you've paid royalties. Traditionally, it's an opaque system, and the labels don't pay 100 cents on the dollar. What can you tell us about that, both in terms of what you paid and also trying to collect?
Well, you know, there's like every single deal, there's two sides to it. I would say that since the record business, it's sort of like everybody says, well, 9 out of 10 acts fail. Well, 9 out of 10 acts were financed by the record companies. So let's say the act fails and they got an advance of $200,000, okay? So the record company gives the act $200,000. They spend $100,000 making the record and they pocket $100,000. Record goes out and bombs. Record label lost $200,000. The act made money for a short time. So the label was a loser in that deal. Now, one out of 10 succeeded. Well, from a business standpoint, the label is thinking, well, that one that succeeds has got to pay for all those losers. So obviously we can't pay 100%, you know, we can't pay like there was no losers, because they don't know who's going to be the winner and who's the loser. So in most record deals, they have to figure that, okay, we can pay a 20% royalty to the act, or a 15% royalty, or a 10, whatever the number is, okay? When it gets up to about 25%, you're getting to the sort of upper reaches of the big superstar deals, you know. But then they've got to do marketing. They got to pay for the staff. They got to pay for buying records onto the radio, all the amount of money that it costs to make a record happen. So I would argue that record labels, in many cases, or in most cases, lose money on an act. Yes, they make money on the winning acts, and they do so because it helps pay for the loser acts. And I've known big winner acts that says, well, why should I pay for the losers? And I'd say, well, you know what? You're right. But then again, who was to know you were a winner? You could have just as easily been one of those losers.
Let's assume you're a winner and the contract says X royalty. Traditionally, labels don't pay 100 cents on the dollar on that.
Well, they don't pay 100 cents on the dollar because they got to pay for the pressing.
No. When we get to the net, okay, and we look at the contract, it says, let's just assume 10% royalty, the net is $1 million. I should get $100,000, okay? It seems that the record company doesn't pay that $100,000. Hasn't that been your experience?
It really depends on the company, what the deal is going to be. I've not had a problem with, I mean, I didn't have a problem with A&M. They paid. We did audits on labels, so we did find money, but we didn't find very much. And most of it was accounting mistakes. Okay. There have been some labels that have been crooked, you know, and that's just a fact of life, you know, and the reality is there are acts that are crooked and there are labels that are crooked. And believe me, I've seen both. Okay. But when you look at the finances of the record business, you realize that a lot of money is thrown away, and a lot of it stupidly, to tell you the truth. And that's the reason why a lot of the deals are not as good as they should be for the winner acts, because the labels are losing on the losers. They got to make it on the winners. And a lot of the labels also, one of the things I learned when I got the EMI is that a lot of the executive salaries are whopping salaries, you know, way higher than they should be. And that the salaries of the executives, I mean, they're more interested in the shares and the salaries than they are, you know, they want to up their fees because they want to break some act. So they bury the loser acts and they wave the flag saying, look, I signed so-and-so, you know. So I have a mixed feeling about, you know, whether deals are fair or not. And I would have to say, having been on both sides of the deal, I've seen things that are unfair on the record side, and I've seen things that are unfair on the act side. But 9 times out of 10, it's the act that makes the money and the record label loses.
Okay. Do you foresee the Police breaking up, and how do you end up as the manager of Sting?
Well, I think Sting was smart enough to know that, you know, it takes a lot more than you know, one guy writing songs and putting a band together. You know, you need an organization behind you. And he knew that I was good at what I was doing. And he also knew that I was good at, let's call it, thinking out of the box, not being stuck in some kind of rules, you know. And he wanted to break the rules, you know. And in the case of the Police, none of us really wanted the Police to break up, even Sting. I mean, because it was kind of like the golden goose. So if you remember back, nobody really made an announcement. Okay, the Police have broken up, now Sting's solo. It kind of like, well, we're not really saying the Police broke up, even though we kind of think they have, but Sting's going to do a solo record and maybe he'll do another Police album. We don't really know. And it wasn't until Andy Summers did a solo record a couple of years later that he had, as a publicity, he kind of said, well, really, the Police have kind of broken up, you know. But we always kind of hid it. None of us wanted to say definitively the Police have broken up, because it was kind of like killing something that was an asset. Why, if you don't have to? A lot of people knew. I mean, Sting knew. I kind of knew that Sting didn't really want to do the Police again, especially when his solo career had happened. But did I want to go out and announce it? No.
Okay, what's the thrill for you in the process? Is it the music itself? Is the marketing? Is the ride? What turns you on that has you doing this?
I don't know that I would put my finger on one thing, but there is a kind of a thrill in taking something that everybody says is a loser and making it a huge winner. There's a lot of fun in that. In a way, it's, but then again, that make it seem like I'm saying, well, I want to go out and say, I told you so. Well, it's not really that. There is a kind of a thrill, you know. When we did the Police at a London show, and I hired a half track to drive us. We did an opening show at Hammersmith Odeon for 3,000 people, a very upmarket, cool venue. Across the street, we decided we'd go a little more punky with a stand up venue called the Hammersmith Palais. And I figured, well, you know, to get across the intersection, we should have some kind of cool image. Let's get an army half track and we'll put the band in the back of it. We'll drive across the street and look kind of cool in the photographs. Of course, when we went out of backstage and we got in the half track and we drove out to the intersection, it was complete bedlam. There were thousands of people there. Luckily, I'd hired a half track or we couldn't have got across the street, you know, because there were thousands of fans there all screaming and yelling and wanting to get a piece of the Police, you know. And that was thrilling, you know, to see people that just were going crazy for something you were helping making happen. That was great, you know. I mean, there were other times, like I was invited to give the keynote speech at the New Music Seminar in New York. And the first couple ones had been kind of small, 300 or 400 people, but this was one that was, I'd heard was going to be kind of big, and there was like 3,000 people there. And I brought out, it was at the Hilton Hotel in New York, and I came out to do my speech, and I'm looking out at a bank of people, of 3,000 some people, thinking, wow, you know, this is big, you know. I do my speech, I walk off the stage, and I'm walking to the side to the door, and this girl comes up to me with a tape in her hand and looks at me and says, and she fainted right in front of me. I'm thinking, you know, my first instinct was, I didn't touch her, you know, like she fainted. And I realized after she was coming so close to the person that she thought by some magic could make her a big superstar. You know, she had her tape in her hand. She just fainted right in front of me. You know, she was so overcome to be in my presence. You know, that was a shock. You know, I'm just some guy, you know, and here's this girl fainting in front of me, you know. And I remember sort of a similar experience, you know, when I went out to introduce the Police at Shea Stadium, you know, 80,000 people. Maybe even a bit more, you know, and I'm doing the introduction. So I walk out on stage, and the minute I walk out, flash bulbs everywhere. The place was electric. There was screams. And I go, ladies and gentlemen, it's time. You know, and the place went berserk. The roar of the crowd. I mean, it was so powerful. I did my introduction. I walked off the stage and I was shaking with it, just the energy of it, you know. And I thought to myself, my God, look what it's done to me. I was on stage for a minute. Those guys are going to be out there for an hour and a half. What's it going to do to them? And you know, something people forget is that they went out there and they were dealing with, I mean, people fainting and people going crazy. And I mean, just the maniacness of it. It was unbelievable. I mean, one of the funny stories that at that show, you know, everybody was trying to get on stage. And at one point, the security guy asked me if I could stay by the stairs because everybody was trying to get up. And he was like losing it, you know. And I said, okay, I'll stop. So over comes the manager of Joan Jett, who has been one of the opening acts. And a big burly guy is coming right behind him, you know. And the manager comes up, and I know what he's going to ask. He says, Miles, you know, do me a favor. You know, Joan Jett's here with her mother and, you know, her parents. Can you put them on stage? And I said, look, the fire marshal's up there right now. Everybody and their mother, the police have got all their – I don't know what if I put anybody else up there, they're going to close the whole show down, you know. And he says, I understand, you know, but anything you can do. And I said, look, believe me, I'll do what I can, you know. He walks off. This big burly bouncer comes up and goes, takes my hand and sort of, I know, Mr. Copeland, I know you're going to do what you're going to do, right? And he takes his hand and walks away. And I look, there's a $20 bill in my hand. The guy had tipped me to put Joe Jett on the stage with 20 bucks, you know. So I go backstage to the band. I say, guys, you will not believe what just happened. You know, I'm going back to get them to bring him out on stage, you know. And I said, they said, what? I said, Joe Jett's manager came up and some bouncer comes up. I just got tipped 20 bucks for putting somebody on stage. So Andy Summers comes up to me and says, okay, give us our share. So I have to give out $5 to Sting, $5 to Stewart, $5 to Andy, and I get $5, you know. So they want, and they're looking at it going, that's great. We just made $5 for the show. And out they walked, you know.
Okay. Traditionally, or not traditionally, but a great number of managers end up going inside to labels. Were you ever offered the gig? Were you ever tempted? Did you want that?
No, not really. I mean, IRS was my label. So in a way I was inside EMI because we sold IRS to EMI. And so I realized what the corporate world was. So it was once a year, they would bring all the label heads together. You know, they would have, you know, Chrysalis and Capital and whatever. We would all have to do our presentation for the year. And I was very good friends with the head guy at EMI, who was a guy named Jim Fifield. And after the presentation, and we'd all good art, you know, talking about acts and all that, he would leave the room and the accountants would come in and they'd say, okay, your target this year is X. You make that number, you get your Christmas bonus. I don't care how you do it. You can fire everybody and cut your overhead, or you're going to have a hit record. Don't care. That's the number you got to make. You make that number, you get your Christmas bonus. You don't make that number, you don't get squat. And we're sitting there at the end of the thing thinking, you know, what are we going to do? Well, of course, you got to figure some way to get your Christmas bonus because that's all you're going to make that year, you know. So that's the corporate world, you know, this whole idea about, you know, artist label, you know, they care about the artist and the music and the art. Nonsense. Wait till the accountants walk in the room. It's the numbers. It's the share value. And that was a world that I was really not going to function well in. Now, Jay Boberg, who by this time, had, you know, who was with me in the label there, you know, I said to him at the end of it, I said, look, you know, I'm not going to last here very long. And I'll bet you, knowing EMI, either is IRS. They're going to close down Chrysalis. They're going to close down IRS. They're going to close down Virgin. They're going to close down these labels. Why would they want so many labels? If I were you, you're a lot younger than I am. You know your way around these companies. If I were you, I'd go out and look for a job right now before they fire you. Because, you know, no one's going to hire me. They're going to think, why would Miles take this job? He's managing Sting. He's making all that money with Sting and the police. And they have all this. They imagine I'm doing all this great stuff, you know. Whereas Jay was just working for IRS, you know. So I said, Jay, do yourself a favor. Go get yourself a job while you have a job. And I think he was kind of upset about it. But sure enough, he takes my advice and he goes off. And a few months later, he ends up as president of MCA Records. And of course, a year later, what happens? Universal closes MCA Records and he's out of a job.
Right. But he survives. The history of the music business is littered with people who had great fortunes and blew them. What happened with all your money?
Well, if I could go back and do it over again, I'd have more money than I have now, for sure. You know, I mean, I did blow money on things I shouldn't have done it on, you know. But thankfully, I did do enough stuff that made money. When I sold Iris Records, I made money. You know, I bought a place in the big, I bought a castle in France, believe it or not, you know, which is appreciated in value. You know, I have my royalties from the Police. You know, I do have money, but I'm not flush like I used to be. I wouldn't walk around and say, you know, I'm a billionaire or whatever, you know, but I'm living fine, you know, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, I'm getting rewarded for things that I did years ago. Just like Sting is, and just like Andy and Stewart are, you know, we all get our royalties for things we did 20, 30 years ago. And I think that's right. You know, we should, you know, because, you know, I went through a lot of sacrifice, just like Andy Summers did and Stewart and Sting. And we all sacrificed to get what we have. And some made more than others. Of course, Sting made out like a bandit. And thankfully, he wrote great songs and he deserves every penny he's got. And a lot of the great artists do, you know. But sure, there are those that blew their money. And thankfully, I was not one that blew all mine.
So what's keeping you busy now other than writing your memoir?
Well, actually, writing the memoir was quite interesting. But I'm very interested in politics and what's going on today. I'm looking, you know, with kind of fear at what's going on in America. And, but, you know, I'm having grown up, one of the, you know, you asked very early on, you know, what was it like, you know, growing up in the Middle East. Well, one of the things that does get into your mind is, you know, what's the position of America in the world and what is the politics of the world? So politics is very much a part of what you live and grow up in places like Lebanon or whatever, you know. And I can't help but remain interested in politics and what's happening with the country and where the future goes. And that's something that, you know, I watch TV every day, just like Donald Trump does, you know, wanting to see what crazy stuff is happening, you know. But I'm also working with guitar players, who I always liked. I work with Steve Vai, Nuno Betancourt, Zach Wilde, Yngwie Malmsteen. I work with Kenny Wade Shepherd, you know, guitarists. I really love the guitar and what the guitar does. And I love musicianship and stuff. I still listen to records. You know, I still listen to a lot of Middle Eastern stuff, as a matter of fact. I'm not married to one particular kind of music, but I'm interested in what's going on in the world, you know, and the human predicament. You know, I'm interested. I'm sitting here in California looking out at, as you must be, looking out at smoke, you know, the environment, you know, where am I, what are my kids going to grow up to be in 20 years, you know, and what's the world going to be? So I think none of us can escape from that fact. So I would say my vision now has become, I mean, it's always been sort of slightly political, but much more so now than it has been in the past.
So, needless to say, the music business has gone through a tumultuous change in the 21st century. And I would also say, as someone who's been around in the era where you had your heyday, music drove the culture in a way it does not today and is not quite as important, even though there are big acts, et cetera. What do you think about music's place in the overall culture today, and what do you think about today's music business?
Well, I'd say the music business has changed a lot. But, you know, a couple of years ago, I sat with Jay Boberg, who was actually had gotten a was running a chairman of a company that was doing digital stuff. And I asked him, I said, you know, what do you think, you know, with the Spotify and the world of digital, and does that mean that all the royalties that I'm getting from the Police and all the stuff that I did over the years, you know, that means it's going to be dissipated? And he said, well, no. He said, just the opposite. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, you know, he said, what's really happened, he said, is that now, even though you're not making a lot per play, you're talking billions. So he said, remember, you know, you go back 20 years, were we ever making money out of Africa? No, it was all piracy and, you know, you'd never get a royalty check from anywhere in Africa. He said, now, if somebody wants music in Gabon or, you know, pick a country, you know, Mali, you know, they have their phone and they want music. Well, they get it on their phone, even if they're paying 2 cents a song, you know, at least it's something. So he said, now we're actually getting royalties from Africa. So he said, multiply Spotify, where, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, maybe you were getting 0.0001 cent a song play. Multiple that times 10 billion, now you're talking real money. So he said, the likelihood is, even though the record business went into a huge slump when the Spotify and the Spotify, a lot of these digital platforms were starting offices, I think the arc is going to go back up again, where those royalty streams will now be meaningful because there's just so many people on it. And he said, the funny thing about the youth today is they figured out paying $9 a month to listen to whatever you want, whenever you want it, is a great deal. It's a lot better deal than in the past, where once a month you get to buy one record for $15 and you only get to hear that one record. You know, you own the record. He said, but you know, $9 a month or $10 a month, whatever it is to get Spotify, he says, you own everything all the time. He said, that's a great deal. It's a lot cheaper for the average kid than buying one record a month. You know, so he said, when you think about it that way, he said, the whole generation is thinking of things in a different way. And you now you look at things like Uber and also, you know, a lot of other businesses. They're really thinking, well, wait a minute, owning something doesn't have quite the same feel as it used to. Owning a car, why? You know, with all the, you know, you got to buy tires, you got to license it, you got to, you know, have repairs, you got to buy gas, you got, well, you know, Uber is pretty easy, you know. So a lot of those sort of ways of thinking, you know, that ownership as a way that used to influence my generation or your generation, they now think of in a different way. And will that change everything in the future? Well, maybe so, you know. I think that in terms of, you know, I said to him, was it time to start a record label? He said, well, no. He said, because the problem is, by the time you build up enough of a catalog to make any money, you've spent so much money doing it that you'll never make it back again. So the way to make money is do what Universal did. You buy EMI. They've already got the catalog. You buy it for $3 or $4 million, you fire everybody. Now all that money goes straight into your system, which is already set up digitally, costs you maybe a few more people, and all that money just flows in with no cost to it, whereas EMI had all the costs. Now they got none. They got no rent. They got no pressing. They got no nothing. You just collapse in it. So Universal now is doing phenomenally well because they lost all the – they have EMI, but with no cost of EMI.
Well, Miles, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for your insight and your history. You're certainly one of a kind. Thanks for doing this.
Happy to be here.
Till next time, this is Bob Leftsets.